The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Anybody know offhand where the rest of your section is?
Just out of curiosity.
Oral arguments?
Okay.
Their loss. Your gain. More pizza for everybody who's here. We're going to go ahead and get started. Grab a folder as you're coming in the box here. There's pizza in the back. You have class at 1:20, 1:30? Yes, no? Yes, okay, we'll be out of here before then. That's our goal anyway. Let me start by introducing the office. I am Dean Jaffe. I've met you at least once at orientation, some of you since then. With me is Myra Wilder, who is Assistant Director for Student Affairs. Myra works with the evening division and also with students who are entitled to accommodations under the ADA. And she also does the yeoman's task of academic advising through our office. In the back is Holly Ann Vickers, who is the ADA coordinator, Student Affairs and ADA coordinator for the office. More importantly, at least of late, she ran point on the puppies that were here in the lobby a couple of weeks back. So give her credit for that. Yes, we hope to have them back at some time, well, probably not before the fall, but sometime, maybe every year, maybe every semester, who knows. So our goal, well, the first thing I'd like to say is just congratulations to all of you. I know you don't see it yet, but you are nearly done with your first year. That's really exciting. You should be proud, and I know exams are still before you. You're thinking, yeah, we're not quite there yet, but I promise you, you're going to be looking up in just a heartbeat and wondering where the time flew by. So congratulations on where you've gotten thus far. Our goal today is to cover a couple of areas. We're going to work our way through the formal graduation requirements. We're going to talk about advanced registration, upper-level course selection, things of that nature. We're going to talk a little bit about the bar exam, but not a lot, because you've got plenty of opportunity for that, including further assistance from our office, and we're going to take your questions as we go. What I'd like to do is just quickly walk through the folder, because we're not going to... I'll refer to it, but briefly, and then I'm just going to invite you to use it as a takeaway, and then we'll roll into the bulk of the... presentation. Just let me know, as questions come up, feel free to throw up your hand and let us know so we can be helpful. So on the right-hand side of your folder, you have an academic planning guide. We're going to cover a lot, but not all of the information that's in there. It's a fairly easy read. When I first inherited a number of years ago, it was about 50 pages. We got it down to a nice, tidy 20 pages or less. I would encourage you to find a place where you do some of your light reading, but read this over the course of the next week or two, and certainly in advance of advanced registration. There'll be a couple of nuggets in there that we're going to, I don't want to say hold you to, but information that should be helpful. On the left-hand side, to aid in your advising, as we get into this academic advising period, and certainly as you get into your second and third years, you have a couple of pieces of information. The top one is your faculty by teaching area. This is a list, not 100% comprehensive, but a list of faculty who teach in the subject areas for which we have several courses, certainly more than one course, or more than one faculty member teaching. Front and back. Actually, no, that page is just... Thanks, sir. Should be front and back. Mine is... single-sided. Do you have double-sided on yours? Do we have them all on one side this year? I thought we had front and back. All right, we'll double-check that. If it's missing, I'll have to get something out via email. Anyway, this will be a good piece. You can read this together with going online to the faculty page on the website if you're looking for additional either faculty information about these individuals, about others. But these are going to be a number of your informal faculty advisors. These are the folks who are going to be teaching you in the upper levels, folks who are going to be working with you on independent studies, maybe some Dean's Fellowship opportunities. So it's good, if you haven't already done so, to start to familiarize yourself with the faculty. Behind that page, you have the 1L faculty advising sessions. These are all finalized. While you don't have the faculty members on there, each of these sessions is going to be hosted by at least two, if not three or more faculty members. We strongly encourage you to attend the sessions of interest to you. Whether you're not sure or you're thinking that it's a subject area in which you might be interested in, this is a better opportunity than going to the faculty members kind of individually seriatim and asking the same questions that you're bound to ask. The kind of generic questions, what should I be taking? What are you going to be teaching it? They will give you a sense, if you have an interest in focusing on a particular area, of what type of coursework you might expect and how they think you might want to consider kind of sequencing in terms of those courses. In terms of those subject areas, if you were to look back to the academic guide, the purple lavender garden on the right, a bulk of it will actually reflect these subject areas and provide you a list of the courses that you can expect to have access to during your second and or third years. So again, you can read those in tandem in terms of planning some of your academic advising. And then the third sheet, which is what I'm going to spend the bulk of the time today on, is the formal graduation requirements. I'm probably not going to go through in the same order that is here, but you'll have that as a takeaway. So that is your folder, probably the last time we're going to go through it unless any questions arise. We're going to go in a little bit of reverse order than we normally do. Myra had agreed to work with one of the legal rhetoric professors on some other work, and as a result of that, we're going to kind of flip it a little bit and just go through first advanced registration, upper-level course selection, things like that. Myra will take her questions, and then she's going to have sent herself close to one, and I'm going to kick back in and take you through the formal graduation requirements. So.
All right. I'm leaving early. I'm going to put my email address up on the board. You can also find the student affairs webpage on the WCO website. A lot of first years will come to me and ask, request an appointment to sit down and discuss course planning over the next 2 years, which is fine. I prefer appointments during this time of year just because it's very busy and I advise you along with the other 1,000 students in the building. So I'm going to put my email address up here before I head out. And if you guys have personal questions or questions that you didn't feel comfortable, you know, addressing in front of your peers, which is okay, certainly shoot me an email. And I'll set up a time to meet with you. You guys don't start registration until until April 17th, so you have another week and a half almost before you actually start. So I'm sure plenty of questions will come up in between now and then. I'm going to go through three things. One is non-classroom credit. One is summer registration, which some of you have already probably done already. And then lastly, registration for the fall, and then if you have any questions about that process, I'm certainly here to answer them, and then I will head out and go handle some of the responsibilities. So you're going to go through formal graduation requirements after I leave, but as you may or may not know at this point, you need 86 credits to graduate from WCL. As a part of those 86 credits, you are allotted what's called 12 non-classroom credits. Non-classroom credits are law credits, or sometimes credits that you earn on main campus. But those are credits that can be applied towards your JD. Okay, 12 is the maximum. If you go above 12 non-classroom credits, you have to incrementally increase your required credits for graduation by one. So for example, if you have 13 non-classroom credits, we're only going to count 12 of those, so you would really need 87 credits to graduate from the law school as opposed to 86. What classifies as non-classroom credit? Well, when you find out about journal on Saturday, if you get onto one of the law reviews or journal, you can take two credits in your 2L year and up to 4 credits in your 3L year. All journal credits count as non-classroom credits. If you're on the moot court, mock trial, or SDR teams, all of those credits that you earn through those organizations are non-classroom credits. If you do an independent study, which you will learn about more as it relates to the upper level writing requirement, independent study credits are non-classroom credits. Externships, for those of you who are doing externship this summer or considering one for next year, the externship program is two parts, your grades is two parts. So the first part is the seminar. For most of you, you'll be doing the pre-credit seminar. And then the second part of that is the fieldwork. The fieldwork component of the externship seminar is going to be based upon how many hours per week you work within the given period, whether it's the summer, the fall, or the spring. Only the externship field work credits count as non-classroom credits. The seminar component is a seminar. You're going to class every week. You're meeting with a professor. You're doing a writing assignment. So that's classroom credit. But any externship field work that you do is counted as non-classroom credit. A thing about the clinics. Clinics are similar to externships in how they're graded. So you have a seminar component and you have a field work component. All of your clinic credits are classroom credits. So if you get to 3L year and you've got 10 non-classroom credits and say you get into the IP clinic, which is 14 credits over the course of 2 semesters, 7 and 7, don't worry about it. Don't come to me and say, oh my God, I can't do clinic because I'm going to go over my non-classroom credits. That's not the case. You'll be fine because all your clinic credits, are non-classroom credits. Finally, you are, under the WCL policy, you are allowed to take up to 6 credits on main campus that can be counted towards your degree. Couple caveats to that. It has to be graduate level coursework. You cannot take an undergraduate language course or an undergraduate course at SIS or an undergraduate course at School of Public Affairs and request that the registrar's office count that. They won't do it, okay? If you take up to 6 credits on main campus, graduate level, and what you should do is request first from the registrar to make sure that those credits will count. Those will be counted as non-classroom credits, but also be counted towards the 86 credits that you need for graduation. Keep in mind that only the credits and not the grades from those courses will count, so they will not be factored into your GPA. There's one exception to that rule. How many people are in dual degree programs? Okay. If you're in a dual degree program, as you probably know, you can transfer up to 6 credits of your master's work towards your JD. It's the same rule as it relates to someone who's not in a dual degree program who wants to transfer credits. You just need to confirm with the registrar whether or not that class is going to count. The example I always use is that there's a human rights class at SIS. The registrar is not going to count that human rights class towards your JD because there's a human rights class here at WCL. Okay? So you just always want to confirm that with the registrar's office. For those of you who are in dual degree programs, you have your 6 credits already that you can transfer. You also, on top of that, still have the 12 non-classroom credits. So if you want to think about it, it's 18 credits. However, you're maxed out at 6 for master's work. So if you take 16 credits over the course of the remaining 2 years here towards your master's, only 6 of those 16 are going to count towards your JD. The other 10 will count towards your master's, and they're still covering the WCL tuition, but they will not come in through the other 12 non-classroom credits that you're allotted. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. So that's non-classroom credits. It'll kind of make more sense when you talk about other formal graduation requirements. Summer registration started at 10 o'clock this morning. Anybody register already for classes? Was it easy?
Yeah.
Okay. So you go on to the MyAU portal. You don't register through MyWCL. Okay, registration is always done through the MyAU portal. You go on, register for classes. You'll notice that on the course schedule for the summer, which is posted on the registrar's website, that the enrollments for the courses are updated in real time. So as someone adds the class, the number will go down by 1. Okay. If that course gets to the point where it has a wait list, you will see an at symbol next to that course number, and that will denote that the course has a wait list. For the summer, you're allowed to take a maximum of 7 credits. You need to take at least 6 credits in order to receive federal financial aid. So for those of you who are participating in any of the summer study abroad programs, you're going to earn 6 credits because you have 2 classes associated with those programs, 3 credits each. Summer, yes.
Oh, I had a quick question relating to fall. I'm trying to sign up for grad classes in addition to law classes for fall, and it's not letting me until I sign up for law classes.
You have to go through your advisor on main campus to sign up for your grad classes.
Yeah, she told me I wouldn't be able to sign up for grad classes until I...
You'll have to wait until your registration. Yeah, you'll have to wait until registration on this. What was I saying? 6 credits, 7 credits maximum. For any of you who are still considering whether or not to take summer coursework, you still have time. The add drop period for the summer does not end until about a week after summer classes start, which is the day after Memorial Day. Keep in mind, though, that if you want to receive federal financial aid for the summer, the application is due by May 1st. It's a 1-page application. You can find it in the Office of Financial Aid. Your FAFSA must be on file in order to receive summer aid, so if it's not on file, you need to contact your financial aid counselor as soon as possible. And that's it. Summer registration is pretty simple. It's not difficult. If you run into a problem, if you have a stop on your account for any reason, you're not going to be able to register for the summer or for the fall. So usually people have stops if they have outstanding library books due or something, an issue with student account. So if you think you're in that boat, you want to get that stuff resolved before you register for the summer or the fall, because we here at the law school cannot lift those stops. Student accounts has to do it. Yes.
Is there a different summer externship for the summer externships that they have here, and once they're done, for the course registration?
Or you mean domestic or international?
Domestic.
Okay, yes. There are 3 types of externships in the summer. So externships that are done in the D.C. metro area, long-distance externships that are domestic, and then long-distance externships that are international. Regardless of where you're externing, you need to still receive a maximum of 6 credits. So it's 3 credits for the seminar and then up to 3 credits for the field work. If you have not already done so, and you have secured a position for the summer, you need to contact Ava Sanders, who's the director of the externship program, and talk to her about what you need to do, because there's some paperwork that has to be signed and a couple of administrative logistics before you can register for the seminar. Usually it's not, you probably can't register yet, but don't worry about it. You'll be enrolled in the classes, whether it's, you'll receive an email from the registrar saying go ahead and register, or the registrar will do it for you themselves. But don't worry about it. You'll be fine and within time for financial aid to be dispersed and all that. So. Any other questions about the summer? Yes.
I'm not sure if this is jumping ahead, but you mentioned that you can tell how many people are registered for a course during the registration period. Can you see that before the registration period or not?
For your registration period, or
yeah.
Well, yes, because 2Ls, I mean, rising 3Ls would have already registered, and I'll get to that in a moment. Okay. So, okay, if there's no other questions about the summer, I'm going to transition into the fall. So, advanced registration for the fall starts on April 17th for you guys. Okay, once your registration time opens up, you're allowed to go into the system and add and drop courses at will up until the add drop period for the fall, which is August 27th, okay? So if your registration opens up, say 10 o'clock on the 17th, which is when the first group registered, you can go back into the portal, 5 hours later and add a drop class. These are the instructions for advanced registration. You can find it in two places. I highly advise that you take this document, read it. It takes less than 5 minutes because it outlines all the instructions for the waitlist. It's not in your folder, so if you're looking for your folder, it's not in there. It outlines the instructions for the waitlist. It also has the lottery. Okay, registration here is done. Is a lottery. The individuals who register first are those who are closest in time to graduation. So advanced registration actually opens on April 10th, but for rising 2L full-time students, it opens up on April 17th. So rising full-time 3Ls and LLM students register first, and then you guys are in the next block. Okay? You will know your registration time by the last digit of your student ID number. Okay? And just for informational purposes, if your ID number ends in 7, you're the first people to register on April 17th. The reason why we do that is because if we had 500 students trying to register on the portal at one time, portal would crash and nobody would get into classes. Okay? Your registration time is set in stone. We cannot change it. We will not change it. Don't call the registrar's office. Don't call me. Don't call Dean Jaffe. It is what it is. More likely than not, some of you sitting in this room, your registration time will open up while you're sitting in a classroom. You got a couple options. You can register while you're sitting in class. You can wait. You can wait until a break. Really, really trust somebody and want them to register for you, which I don't recommend that you do, but some people have done that in the past. But we cannot change your time, okay? So just be strategic about it and do it whenever you feel you're most comfortable doing it. As Dean Jaffe will discuss this, but as you all probably know, there are two required courses remaining: criminal procedure and legal ethics. Criminal procedure you will take in the fall. You must take criminal procedure in the fall if you don't take it this summer. So, when you register for the fall, you will select your crim pro section. We are not assigning you to a criminal procedure section. So when you're thinking about scheduling and start designing your schedule, because if you don't already know, the course schedule is up for the fall, pick a section of crim pro or pick multiple sections of criminal procedure and design your schedule around that, because you have to take criminal procedure in the fall. No exceptions to that rule. The other thing to keep in mind is that the registrar's office reserves a certain percentage of seats in some evening courses for part-time students. So, for example, there are 3 sections of evidence this fall. There are 3 sections of business associations. There are 2 sections of federal personal income tax. Those evening sections, which you will know they're evening sections because they begin at 6 p.m., all of those sections have spots reserved for part-time students. So, as the registration goes along and you see the numbers changing for the enrollment, you may see that for evidence, there's 99 spots, but only 45 people are registered for it. And as the next day goes by, only 46 people are registered for it, which for Evidence would be odd because Evidence is obviously a course that all students should take before they graduate. The reason why those numbers are increasing so slowly is because Evidence has been blocked off to full-time students for the registration period. However, a couple of weeks after registration ends, the registrar's office will release all unregistered seats to the general student population, and then you can go ahead and register for those sections if you want to. And again, they remain open until August 27th, which is the end of that drop. Okay? We have a waitlist procedure here at the law school. Okay, again, I mentioned with summer registration, it's the same thing for the fall. If you see an at sign next to that course number, that means that course has a waitlist. We have new waitlist procedures in effect starting for the summer, and it's going to be applicable thereafter. You are maxed out at 5 waitlists. So be careful about what classes you want to add yourself to the waitlist for. You're allowed to go into the portal and add and drop yourself from a waitlist, so we don't have to do that for you, with one exception. If you are enrolled in, say, Section 5 of Criminal Procedure, and you'd like to be on the waitlist for Section 1 of Criminal Procedure, you won't be able to do that through the portal. You'll have to call the registrar's office yourself and request that they put you on the waitlist for that class. If you're already maxed out your 5 waitlists, they're going to say to you, you need to pick a class to drop, and then we will add you to the waitlist for the other section. So just keep that in mind. If you want to be on the waitlist for a different section of the same course, you will not be able to do that yourself through the portal. Yes.
Is that about and enroll in the class, does the waitlist stay or does it go away?
Like, if you're being strategic about it, if you enroll in a class and then you try to get on the waitlist, you can't do that. But if you get on the waitlist first, would you then enroll in the other class?
Well, depends. Probably not. But, I mean, I use the Crim Pro example because you should be enrolled in a section of Crim Pro
right. When
you register. Because if you don't get into it, if you don't get off the waitlist for another section, and then every other section has a waitlist, then you have a problem. So enroll and then add yourself to the waitlist for another section. Does that make sense? Okay.
Just to clarify, it's 5 waitlists per semester. You're allowed to be on the waitlist for 5 classes per semester.
And the way, it's actually kind of cool, the way the portal will tell you what number you are on the waitlist, how many people are on the waitlist, what the maximum enrollment for the course is. So you can get a pretty good sense of whether or not you have a good chance of getting into the class. And again, remember, add drop period is basically 4 months long. So you're going to find 3Ls taking up spots in classes that they ultimately are not going to take. Yeah, most students get into the classes that they want. You just have to be patient, and you're not going to get that perfect schedule the first go around. Because face it, by the time you guys register, a lot of classes are going to be closed out, especially those smaller seminars with 15, 16 people, because you got 3Ls who have been waiting to take that class for 2 years who are now going to register for those courses. Just be patient with the process, because sometimes you don't always get what you want in the beginning, but most students at the end will get what they want at the end.
Is there a maximum of credits you can register for?
You can. So, yeah, and Dean Jaffe was going to cover this, but I guess I'll just. Your full-time tuition covers 12 to 17 credits. Okay, a 17th credit is considered a high credit load, and so before you decide to take a 17th credit, you need to come to our office, speak to myself or Dean Jaffe about why you want to take the 17th credit. Most of the time, we'll say okay. However, 17 credits is a lot of credits, and it's a lot of work. And once you commit yourself to that, you commit yourself to that. I mean, you don't want to come back to us in the middle of the semester and say, oh, you were so right, I should not have done this, 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 and this. And then you're looking at possibly withdrawing, and then you have a W on your transcript, and it snowballs. So if you don't need to take 17 credits, don't take 17 credits.
Sorry, just to verify, I mean, if you were going to adjust things during the add drop period, so you wanted to start out with more credits,
You can go up and down during add drop.
But you can only sign up for 17.
Yes. The system will not allow you to sign up for any more than 17. Any other questions about registration?
If you're planning on doing an externship in the fall, but you don't have it set up yet, should you wait to register for that?
You can register for the seminar. The fieldwork component you don't have to register for right now because you may not know how many hours you're going to do, but you are allowed to register for the seminar. And again, ultimately you decide not to do the externship, you just have to remember to drop the class.
But it's just
didn't say, actually. these instructions are on the registrar's website. It says pre-registration 2012, and then also on the registrar's MyWCL page. Okay, if you click on registrar, you'll see a bunch of forms on the right-hand side. The link is pre-registration 2012. Please read this. Registration is not difficult. It's just you just want to make sure you're prepared before you log into the system. And again, if you've done the summer already, you're already a pro at it. It's not that hard.
Any
other questions? Yeah.
All right.
Is there a journal or a journal where you offer to credit your credits?
Yeah.
I'll cover that.
So, when we figure out how, what time we start up, it depends on the last digit of our. How would we figure that out?
Read the instruction. Read the instruction.
No. How does it determine the time?
It's randomly assigned by the registrar's office.
So how do we figure out what that time is?
It's on the instruction.
Where
is that?
Where is that?
Two places.
Okay.
My WCL page for the registrar. As well as the registrar's website.
If you Google WCL advanced registration, it comes right out of the box.
Okay. All right. Okay, we're going to transition over. We can keep taking your questions. The most important thing you need to know right now is there's more pizza in the back. So if you haven't had enough, feel free to go ahead and grab a slice. The second most important thing you need to know for the balance of our time here is to ensure that you understand the formal requirements. Some of them you'll trip across and won't be a problem, but we want to make sure that you completed them from graduation, because if you don't, there's no graduation for you, at least in the May that you're looking to do so. So,
we're going to work our way through them. First one, 86 credits, as Myra mentioned. That's a floor, not a ceiling, okay? You have to have the 86 credit earned come May 14.
That's right. Thank you, Myra.
You're welcome.
But it's a floor, not a ceiling. As Myra mentioned, students may earn between 12 and 17 credits in any one semester. Okay, that 17th one, as you heard, you need permission. 12 is minimum for full time. We're going to do a little bit of math for the remaining half hour. But really, Mike, you all came to law school because you didn't want to do math, and I appreciate that. At the end of the first year, the majority of you will have completed 29 credits. Okay, some of you may be a little bit north of that, a third elective credit, maybe the LAP program for some of you were in prior to law school. Most of you are looking at 29 credits, 14 in the fall, 15 in the spring, is a total of 29. You back that out from the 86 that you need to graduate, you end up with 57. You divide that over the remaining four semesters, and you're going to average 14 and a quarter credits per semester. We don't have quarter or half credit, so that's just an average. And that is assuming no summer work, okay? So if you're planning on doing no summer work, you know that's about, the 14 credits is about where you need to be during your remaining, your second and third year. That being said, a good number of you I know are going to be earning summer credits starting this summer, maybe next summer as well. Whether it's summer study abroad, summer classes here, an externship program. And further, I'm guessing those of you who choose to do so are probably going to be registering for a minimum 6 credits during the summer, because you need 6 credits to be eligible for federal aid. Maximum number of credits during the summer is 7. So you're looking between 6 and 7. You're certainly entitled to seek, register for and complete fewer than that, but then you're going to be paying out of pocket for it. The reason I raise it now, as we get into the residency, is that some of you, if you decide to earn, let's say, 6 credits or whatever number during the summer, you are entitled to earn fewer credits in a subsequent semester and bank those together. I am not the Office of Finance. I am your counselor and advisor. I don't want you to have to spend more money in tuition than you need to. Not that Office of Finance wants you to either, but they would be happy with the money. You're more than welcome to earn summer credits and stay full-time, but you don't have to. So, rolling into the second requirement, the reason I'm raising that, the residency requirement. Full-time students must complete 6 semesters of 12 credits or greater, or the equivalent. That's what the ellipsis is, okay? The equivalent means if you have a semester or summer session in which you've earned fewer than 12 credits, you can bank that in essence, couple it with another subsequent semester so that the two of them added together give you the minimum 12, and you'll be fine.
Most students take advantage of this through a summer session, which they then hold on to, and typically, I'd say for most, you're getting into that last semester of your third year, you're feeling either burnt out or half checked out of school, you're on your way, some of you may still be looking for employment and looking for additional time to do that. So you may drop, and I'm just doing the math, you know, the math here, you may drop to as few as 6 credits in that final semester. We'll couple those two, that summer session and the 6 in that semester together on paper to give you the minimum 12. That's your 6 resident semester, and you'll be fine. Okay, everybody okay on that? Basic math. Again, if you stay full-time throughout, this isn't a question again. If you're looking to earn summer credits, you still can stay full-time, but you also can take advantage of this and pay a little bit. When you drop below 12 credits, if it's not obvious to some of you, you're paying per credit, and that's where you're making up the money in that regard. Okay, we're okay there? Yeah.
You still get financial aid if you're going part-time for
a... You can have to be registered for a minimum of 6 credits, and you get a pro rata portion on the tuition because you're not going to get the aid for full tuition when you're not registered with that many credits. But yes, you do. So we're okay on residency. There will be some shifting. The other thing that comes up oftentimes, a lot of the work that our office does between orientation and commencement and between these sessions and the bar exam sessions that we're going to do is one-on-one counseling. Family issues come up, illnesses come up, need to drop down a lesson full-time. Again, most of you will trip across these requirements, but when an issue comes up that you think is putting you in a slightly different situation, that's when you need to find me or find Myra so that we can walk you through the steps so that you don't let an issue become too large at the end of the day, and then we're near the eve of commencement, and we say, you know, sorry, we'll probably allow you to walk if you're close, but you're not going to get that diploma. That's when we need to be seeing you. Okay? I put up here in the corner, before I miss it, Myra had mentioned the fact that at the end of your first year, you can have 2 required courses remaining, criminal procedure, legal ethics. Crim Pro is offered in the fall, legal ethics in the spring. Both courses, however, are offered in the summertime. So those of you who have not yet finalized summer decisions and or maybe working during the day but hadn't been thinking about taking coursework might want to consider coursework. The courses are in the evening, these anyway, as well as a number of other courses during the summer. They don't conflict with each other. One thing to keep in mind, criminal procedure is 3 credits, legal ethics is 2. If you're looking to take the 2 of them over the summer, you can do the math, that's 5. If you want to be eligible for federal aid, you need to pick up an additional credit. It could be one of the academies. Those courses typically run during the day, several hours a day over 3 or 4 days. You can pick up 1, 2 credits over the course of several days or no more than a week or so. You could consider an independent study, which we'll get into in a couple of minutes. The advantage of doing this during the summer is simply that it'll give you a little bit more space in the fall and spring when you don't have to otherwise take those courses to take some of your electives. Heed Myra's warning from a little while ago. You must take criminal procedure and ethics. You're not going to be registered for it. There will be multiple sections. You don't want to show up in the registrar's office and say, I didn't know I had to, because you're on notice through these sessions, and you won't be able to matriculate. You actually will end up being on leave for an entire year until you can get back on cycle and complete them. So make sure you take care of that. All right. 86 credits in residency. Writing requirement. Yes, ma'am.
You have to take those next semester?
You have to take criminal procedure no later than next fall, and legal ethics no later than next spring. Okay? Writing requirement. Yes?
I'm just wondering, how much does it cost, like, per credit? So if you were to take a summer class, let's say you were just going to take the criminal procedure for 3 credits, do you know how much that would be?
I'd be making up the number. It's somewhere around it's about $1,800 per credit. Somebody help me out.
Yeah.
I mean, you'll find it on the website, and the numbers will roughly wash out. You're trying to help me, your classmate. You're shaking it. Yeah.
I would say it's $1,680 or like right around there.
$1,680. Okay. To the extent that the Board of Trustees has a plan in place, and that includes some kind of tuition hike, and I know it frustrates students, sometimes frustrates me as well. The tuition hike always takes place after the summer session. So if any of you are trying to calculate and plan accordingly, your fall, spring, summer session tuition is locked in each year, and then whatever increase, if there is one, is going to change the following fall, if that's helpful. Okay?
Do you know where we find the exact numbers for courses online?
On the registrar's
webpage. Yeah. Writing requirement. Between the end of the first year of graduation, students must have completed at least 1 writing assignment that meets the research and writing expectations as certified by a professor for minimum competency of WCL graduate. The writing requirement has to be reflected in a project for which a student has earned a minimum of 2 credits and written a minimum of 30 pages. Okay? Typically, 3 ways and this is going to be fulfilled. One is on a journal. Some of you, as Myra said, are waiting on write-on. Others might be either waiting or hopeful of the opportunity to grade on over the summer. As part of your obligation with journal, you're going to have to write a note or comment for that journal. In your second year, first year on journal, you earn 2 credits for your work with journal. That will satisfy the credit component. On the page length side, the minimum 30 pages, you will sail past that with your note or comment. You're probably going to be hovering between 60 and 80 pages for the note and comment, and so you should be fine there. One thing to keep in mind, however, you need to have, remember, the writing requirement certified by a professor. To do that through a note or comment, there's going to be a blackout period. You get a period of time where you can approach a professor, ask some questions generally about the topic, which direction does a professor think you should move in, and then you've got to go away and work on your own. And then the next time you come up for air with that is when you submit the final copy to the journal. You want to ask that professor, if you're looking to have the writing requirement fulfilled through that process, ask the professor ahead of time. You don't want to first be approaching a professor at the end of the process and saying, I did this great paper, I know you write or teach in this area, would you read it and certify it? They don't want to be pigeonholed, they're likely going to say no. They wanted to have an opportunity for even minimum input at the front end. If you've done that, once you've submitted the final paper to the journal, you then go to the professor and say, I've submitted to the journal, as we had met early on or in the summer, whenever it was, I'd like to submit this to you for certification. In most cases, the professor will read it, say it looks great, sign it, you're done, you don't have to worry about the writing requirement again. In some instances, the professor might say, I'm glad the journal seems to be accepting this as publishable quality for journals purposes. The reason you approached me is that I'm an expert in this area. I kind of feel like it needs a little bit more work or massaging in this or that area. You'll talk about it a little bit, you go away for a little while, do some work, resubmit it, get it certified, and you should be fine. Okay? That's alternative one. For those of you who choose not to be on journal, or maybe you're not fortunate enough to make it on if you chose or tried to get on, you're still going to have ample opportunity. A number of your upper level courses are going to be paper-based courses. Okay? We're going to get into a little bit more math here. Some of those courses, the professors will advertise that the paper in the course meets the upper level writing requirement. What that means is that they're going to provide some oversight and that they are going to have a 30-page requirement for that course. Most of the courses, however, don't automatically meet the 30 pages. It's usually a smaller paper than the 30 pages. So the example we're going to use here is that you're registered for a 2-credit seminar, and the seminar has, we'll do easy math, the seminar has a 10 to 15 page component, maybe doing some simulations with it as well, but the paper requirement is 10 to 15 pages. You have 2 options. You can go to the professor and say, I'd like the paper I'm doing for your seminar to also meet the writing requirement, so I'm going to, with your permission, write up to 30 pages. We'll meet a couple of times, whatever the agreement is. I'll submit it, get certified, and we're done, and that's fine. The point, though, is that if it's a minimum 10-page requirement, you might say, if I'm writing additional 20 pages, I'd like to see if I can earn additional credit. And you can. The law school has an independent study project feature, which basically means you're engaging in research and writing for a professor, and it's basically reflected in page length. A 1-credit independent study is a 20 to 25 page paper. So here's where the math comes in, pretty basic. You go to the professor, you say, in addition to the seminar, I'd like to certify to meet the writing requirement, and I'd like to seek and receive an additional 1 credit for it. You take the minimum page length that's already been requested for the seminar, the minimum page length for the independent study, and you're looking at a minimum 30-page paper for which you'll earn the 2 credits in the seminar, the 1-credit independent study, 3 credits total. You get the grade for the seminar based upon that paper. You get certified and you're on your way. Okay? Pretty straightforward. That's the toughest math we're going to do. Arguably, you get a little bit tougher, but I think you can hack it. But again, it's going to be the same thing. If it's a 15 to 25 page paper, 20 pages, you're looking at 35. Okay? Great way to do it. The third way is really just an offshoot of the second one, which is that if for whatever reason, you haven't taken a paper-based seminar, and I hope that you do because it's great to build upon the legal rhetoric, the writing skills that you're picking up. But for some reason, you've either chosen not to write a longer paper or you haven't come across that. You can always seek an independent study, just a flat-out independent study, with the professor. 1-credit independent study, 20 to 25 pages. A 2-credit independent study is 26 up to 50. So your common denominator there, 2-credit independent study, minimum 30 pages, meeting whatever instructions of the professor in terms of font and double spacing. Substantive footnotes can be included, so it can't be a bibliography of the resources that you used, but as long as it's applying towards the paper, you should be fine. Take care of that. You get that certified. A purple form gets signed by the professor and submitted to the registrar. You've taken care of the writing requirement, and that's done. Okay? Yes?
Sorry,
I
zoned up for a quick second. There's the one-credit independent study, the two-credit independent.
Yeah, they're all the same. It's all a 799. It's a 799 number. And it's just the credits reflect the page length. So okay. 1 is 20 to 25, 2 is 26 to 50, 3 is 51 on up, and we don't go beyond 3. Anything else on that? Good. Final requirement, practical skills component. The ABA mandates that students have taken and successfully passed at least one course that has a practical skills component to it. It might be a simulation, it might be arguments, it might be a debate, it could be some of the contracts courses have kind of contract construction, things like that. You must take and successfully complete one course. This is a passive requirement, which means in contrast to the writing requirement, we have to get a paper signed. So long as one of these courses shows up on your transcript, you'll be fine. The majority of you will trip across this through completion of the externship program and or the clinical program. Those both fulfill it. If for some reason you don't look to take advantage of either of those programs, there are many other courses that will also fulfill it. And the best way to know that you've done so is when you go onto the WSL website, under the course selection, there's a button kind of on the top right-hand side that says practical skills or professional skills, I forget which. You click on that, it'll show you the subsequent semester, all of the courses that are eligible. So long as you're registered for one of those courses between your, at the end of your first year, none of your electives don't count for that, but between your first summer and graduation, you fulfilled one of those, you'll be fine, you don't have to worry about it again. Yes?
I know they're going to offer a legislative clinic
yes.
this semester. Is
yes.
that, will that count in the practical?
I believe that it will, yes. I'm near certain that it will. And I don't know if they're going to call it a clinic or a practicum. I just, until they finalize that, I want to be clear. But yes, it should. And I'll double check with Professor Youngman on that. Those are the four requirements. Again, pretty straightforward. You fulfill those, you're going to be fine. You're full-time, you stay full-time, should take care of it. If at any point in time, because you've either had to make a switch or you've forgotten everything we've talked about during this hour and you want to be sure, you can always come and check with us. What Myra and I are going to say first is to ask you to request a degree audit from the Office of the Registrar. They will print an unofficial transcript. They'll stamp a little box in the corner. It'll show all of the formal requirements. It'll basically give you a snapshot of where you are at the time of that request. With that, you can sit down with somebody in the registrar or come next door to us. We'll sit down with you and say, either confirm where you are or if you requested the audit because you're thinking you need to make a change in your last semester session, we'll talk about that as well. One thing I wanted to go back to, and then we'll touch on the bar exam and we'll be done. I mentioned that earning the 6 credits during the summer. Some students will decide, and don't hold me on the math here, but this is your first year, your second year, you've done, let's say, a summer session here. The math isn't going to add up exactly, but you'll come back and say, I'd like to do 9 credits each here and here. And since you said that we can bank these and add them, I'd like to have 3 credits go here and 3 credits go here, and that'll give me 6 full-time semesters. Cannot do that. You can't break up this summer session, is all that I'm saying, because actually the ABA standard has to do with the number of class days in which those credits are being earned. So you certainly could. What I was describing is that you would be, again, don't hold me to 86 because I can't do the math that fast, but you could do, you know, as few as 6 here, and that would be your last semester, so long as the total added up to 86. You just can't break up the summer session. Is that clear? Also, although I can't remember the last time a student did this, it is mathematically possible to graduate in 2.5 years, okay? You could earn the maximum number, 6 or 7 credits in both summers, and by taking a heavier credit load and heavier semester here, graduate in the end of that fall semester. The reason students typically do it, one, you're going to be really busy for several semesters making up the credit work. Second of all, the clinic program typically is off the table for you if you're looking to do it because it's typically a 2-semester program. And then the externship programs are oftentimes taken advantage of also during that third year. And it's a lot to be taking on. But I like to put it out there. And I think on the math, you're not really saving a lot in finances. But you're welcome to sit down with a calculator if you want to sit down with me individually and go through all the credits and see where it takes you. Happy to do so. Be happy to talk about that. Okay? Yes?
Do you know if you go part-time in your last semester, if you can still do clinic?
So
two things. If you're a full-time student, this sounds like semantics. You're actually not going part-time. You're dropping down to less than a full-time load, but just to put that out there. Most clinics are going to be 7 credits per semester, which means you could do that. Depending on how you set it up, you might technically only need 6 credits in that semester, so you would be paying for an additional credit. But if that's all you need, the clinic isn't going to force you to be full-time. There's no other requirement there, so yes, you can do it.
Other questions? I'm wondering with the non-class credits, like with Moot Court and Journal,
yeah.
Can you, I know they're offered a couple credits each. Can you not take those?
That's kind of an it depends. Journals are going to make you take them. The moot court and the mock trial, we sometimes have been flexible with, but you typically don't need to avoid them because you're afraid you're going to exceed the 12 credits. It's a very rare circumstance that you'll exceed them. If a student ends up in a situation, we'll talk about it. Our reluctance in not having the credits appended is that we've had occasions occur where a student drops the ball, so they don't ask for the mock, let's say, moot court credits, and then they don't show up for a competition because they think, what's the school going to do to me? I didn't register for credits. And so our policy has been that you have to have a really good reason not to seek those credits. And we could address that on a case-by-case basis. If it comes to that, I probably would have the student say, I understand that if I fail to meet these obligations, I can have a failing grade imposed upon my record. So assuming we meet that, if there was an issue that was there, we could address it.
Is it 2 credits a semester for?
It's a maximum of 3 per semester, 12 overall.
Yeah.
Okay. To touch on the bar just a couple of minutes, and then we'll wrap things up, assuming there are no additional questions. I say we touch on the bar exam lightly because it really is as distant a way as it ought to feel like right now. We will do a session for second year, for your class in the second year, which will talk about jurisdiction selection, reciprocity, looking at the actual courses that may be, or the subject areas that may be assessed. And then in third year, we're going to do yet a slightly different version where we talk about the actual mental, physical preparation for the bar. We bring in alumni who passed the most recent bar in the primary jurisdictions for our graduates. You'll talk to them. You'll be well prepared in that regard. The main thing I'd like to share here, I'll give you a very quick breakdown, a synopsis of the bar, and lead into the pretty much one reason for it. The bar is typically broken down into 2 days. One is a multi-state portion, the MBE, multi-state bar exam, 200 really, really hard multiple choice questions, testing you on a number of subject areas for which you average about 1.8 minutes per question. The other day is your essay day, and that's when the jurisdiction gets to test you on the subject areas that they believe you should have minimum competency to practice in their jurisdiction. The good news for the multiple choice is that at the end of your first year, you will have taken all of the subject areas that are tested on the MBE, except for one, and that subject is? Say it all louder because I heard a whole one. Evidence. Evidence is the one course. Unless you sit for the bar in the state of Louisiana, which doesn't test you, it doesn't do the MBE, you're going to have evidence assessed as a portion of the bar exam, which is why a number of schools, although not us, have it as a required course. We don't. Now, some of you are going to need to take it as a prereq or a co-req for trial ad, for clinic, probably for those two primarily. Some of you are going to take it because you understand it's a good, helpful course to have for litigation and things like that. Some of you may decide that you don't need it while in school, but still are thinking, I probably should take this because Dean Jaffe thought it was a good idea and other classmates have told me as well. Go ahead and wait if you'd like to the highest proximity to graduation, your last semester if you choose, where you're going to have several sections to choose from, and you'll also have it proximate in time to the bar exam a couple of months following in July. We don't compel it, but we're strongly going to encourage you to take it, okay? Beyond that course, that takes care of the MBE. The essay portion is somewhat different. Each jurisdiction varies in the subject areas in which they may test you. They must, by regulation, list the subject areas that they can test you on. That list is always going to be broader what they do test you on, but if they don't list it, they can't test you on it. So as you get into the middle of your fall semester of your second year, we'll encourage you to start thinking about or looking at what you think the bar jurisdiction might be. And we'll do some counseling in the second year on how you might make those decisions. A graduate who's planning on practicing in Virginia is going to sit for the Virginia bar. An employer is probably going to mandate it. Somebody who's thinking about the federal bar or just practicing with the government or things of that nature might consider the D.C. bar. Although the rumors you hear are true, you can waive into the D.C. bar. If you pass another bar, you got to pay for it. And if you're paying out of pocket, you know, $1,000 for the bar, character and fitness fees and whatnot, there are some instances where it actually makes sense to take the D.C. bar straight up. We're not going to get into that now, but we will talk more about it.
later on. There's a great resource. It's the National Conference of Bar Examiners, and their website is ncbex.org. You can go through that to the jurisdiction you might be thinking about. They will list for you the subject areas that you may be tested on. I do not encourage, I repeat, I do not encourage that you start utilizing this as you're making your registration selections for next fall and spring. Okay, there may be a temptation to do so. Some of these courses you're going to trip across anyway. BA, our business associations, one of the most commonly assessed subject areas on the bar. It's called corporations, but that's what BA is. Wills, trusts, and estates may appear, tax, sales or secure transaction, negotiable instruments, family law, and then there's kind of a really tailing off depending on the jurisdiction. As you get into the latter stages of your second year and certainly the third year, to me the best rule of thumb is taking a look at your GPA, giving yourself a self-assessment on the basis of GPA. Where do I understand I am with respect to the class? And as a reflection of that, what is my grasp into the materials? All the GPA is really reflecting is that a 14-week period for a particular class has allowed you ample time to grasp the materials, not enough time to grasp materials. It's really a reflection, particularly if your GPA is kind of, you know, leveled after the first year into the second year. This is how I'm doing. I grasp materials really well, which seems to be reflected in the regurgitation on the exam or the paper. So I probably have a little bit of space to take fewer of those subject areas because the bar prep course and my own knowledge will allow me to grasp it pretty readily. If my GPA is lower than my, and everybody wants to have a better GPA, but lower than I can kind of guess the typical student has had, that probably means, does not mean I'm going to fail the bar, but it does mean that I've had a little bit more of a challenge of grasping the materials, and the more subjects that I've not seen for the first time, or I don't see except for the first time after I graduate, I'm sitting in the bar prep, that's more information that I'm going to have to assess and assemble and kind of get through during that 10-week period leading up to the bar, okay? So again, I'm not saying two different things at the same time. I am saying your education is yours. You came here for certain things. Some of you are developing that interest as you get into the second year and into the third year. We want you to take the courses that are of interest to you. But we want you to pass the bar because we're planning on practicing. You need it. So there's a little bit of a balance that takes place. Again, some of these courses, bless you, some of these courses you will trip across and it won't be a problem. Others you might be thinking about, maybe as I look into advanced registration for the spring of my second year, I'll take one course with an eye towards the bar. Maybe I take one additional one in the fall of my third year, one additional one in the spring of the third year, and I'm on my way. Others might say I'm going to look a little more carefully because I'm just anxious about where my GPA has been, and I do want to take my own mix of my interest, my education, but I also want to be prepared for that. And we will do individual counseling if you have concerns about that as it arises. We're happy to have that conversation. We are at 1:20 by the clock I see over your head and this one. Happy to take any questions about anything we've covered or anything you thought we were going to cover and we didn't. Yes?
How does PILCP factor into the fall curriculum?
It's a heavy course load, but it's available. A couple of the credits are SAS credits, and then the balance are JD credits, and they are all considered, the WCL credits are considered classroom credits, not clinic. There's been a little back and forth on that, but we deem them classroom credits. Other questions? Yep.
Sorry, I just want to make sure. The 86 credits, you said it's a four, so that's not a forced graduation. It's like a set of 87 credits that
right. Graduated. Yeah, it's a floor. So you can, I've seen students who've earned, you know, 93, 94 credits. If the space is there and you have the interest, that's your tuition. The full-time load, if I didn't put this up, I did. The full-time load is the 12 to 17. If you can fit them in, you know, inside there and you want to take additional course loads, you will have a better sense at the end of the first year what kind of course load you can maintain. You're going to know that, but you're also going to be thinking, externship, if I'm doing one, means I'm traveling. I'm probably commuting at least to downtown. That's a little bit of travel time. If I'm doing clinic, 7 credits typically per semester. And again, meeting with clients, doing some intake, things like that. Great program, one of the best in the country, but it's going to mean a little bit of flexibility in that regard. So again, keep in mind, I erased it, but keep in mind that 14 credit average will get you there. And of course, if you're earning summer credits, if you were to stay full-time with the summer credits, that average will drop. If you're looking to use that and kind of bank it, then you're still going to be at about that average at the end of the day. All right? Final questions? All right, seeing none, I'll stick around for a couple minutes. Your class is in this room, is that correct? So just do me a favor, either before or after that class, clean up around you. And thank you.